Welcome back to another episode of the Downstairs Care Out There blog podcast. My name is Mitchell Thomas. I'm recording today, Monday the 16th of March, at about 9 o'clock in the morning. What I do have for you today is a little bit of an impromptu podcast. I really wasn't expecting to do this one, but I had a conversation with Dr. Min Le Cong the other day. You may know Min from Twitter. He goes by @ketamin. And he was a great help to me by coming onto Skype and giving me a bit of a rundown on beginnings and starting out as a practitioner that performs RSI. I don't currently perform RSI in my service, nor do many people outside of our helicopter paramedics perform RSI. So I had to crowdsource it and go to Foamed to find someone who would help me, and Min answered the call, so I'm incredibly thankful to him for that. Apart from that, I've really got nothing to add. I'll let the podcast speak for itself. Thanks for listening.
So yeah, basically the reason I was looking to talk to someone today was we've got a project for my graduate certificate in intensive care paramedics.
Good.
And basically the project was to have a quick chat to someone who has done or regularly performs RSI, or like rapid sequence airway interventions. Obviously, we don't do this in my service, so I took to Twitter and you answered.
Yeah. No, look, I'm happy to. I think, give you a hand there, and if you need to do that for your academic assignment, yeah.
Yeah. So basically all I've asked us to do is just, like, sit down and have a really informal chat with someone about kind of the process of RSI, the why you do it, and just kind of some of the errors that beginners will make, and explain some of the terminology.
Okay.
Behind it.
Yeah, no problem, mate. No problem.
Lovely. So basically, initially, we'll start out with what is an RSI, or a rapid sequence induction, or a rapid sequence intubation, depending on what people are calling it this week.
Sure. Its original description was by two anaesthetists in America, Peter Safar and John Stept, I think, and that was back in 1964, I believe. And the copy of the paper that they published describing it is openly available. I can happily send you the link.
Yeah, that'd be great.
But basically, that is the very first description of what RSI was. And they actually called it rapid sequence induction and intubation. So technically, it's RSII.
Okay.
But it's often forgotten that it's, I guess there's two components essentially to the procedure of rapid sequence induction intubation, is that it is an induction, so you are bringing someone from a conscious or a semi-conscious state to a fully unconscious state. That's the whole idea of it.
Yeah.
That's the induction part. And there's obviously the tracheal intubation part. And the whole rapid thing is to do both those components rapidly, to induce anesthesia rapidly and then to intubate the airway rapidly. And if you look at the original description, the whole reason to do that was to prevent complications of regurgitation and aspiration of vomitus and regurgitant fluids and solids. And that's the whole thing. It's to basically, in anesthesia, it's the textbook definition is that the technique to rapidly secure an airway for the protection of against aspiration regurgitations. And that's really, I guess, the original description. Having said that, emergency medicine, pre-hospital care, critical care, we've kind of evolved or modified it. So sometimes it's called a modified rapid sequence. So therefore, our goals may not be so much protecting the airway from aspiration, but it might be just securing the airway quickly to allow ongoing resuscitation care. So we kind of have slightly different goals, but the original anaesthetic goal was to rapidly secure the airway to prevent aspiration regurgitation in the unfasted patient. And that was that's the other qualifiers. It's generally it was someone who was considered to be unfasted or with a full stomach.
Okay.
So that's what it is. And how you do it, there's actually 18 steps in the original article. They actually have a very involved process, which has evolved throughout the years, and some people, like anything in medicine, you know, 100 different people will do it 100 different ways and say that that's the right way. That's just the nature of things. Sorry, you had a question?
No. I was going to ask why we do it in the current in the current times, but you're going on a good point there, so.
So why do we do it currently? It is still an accepted way to rapidly secure the airway. So even though it started anesthesia, and it's moved to other areas, emergency medicine, ICU, pre-hospital care, it is still considered the fastest and most reliable way to secure an airway in someone who is awake and got intact airway reflexes, and you want to rapidly secure their airway, and it is still, you know, a number of publications have proven that amongst a wide range of providers, that is still the most rapid and most successful way to give you the most optimal conditions for success for tracheal intubation. So that's been widely accepted, and a number of large registry studies have confirmed that, particularly the NEAR study out of North America. In Australia, we have the fledgling Australian New Zealand Airway Registry, which is now about 5 years into data collection, and that once again shows that rapid sequence intubation technique is the most commonly used and seems to be the most successful technique for a rapid securing of the airway. So that's why we still do it in pre-hospital care. It's interesting. It's controversial. It is controversial in that we don't have any good convincing studies to say it actually improves outcome. The only convincing randomized study that I know of that I often quote in my own research is the Victorian MICA trial, the paramedic RSI trial for traumatic brain injury, who lead author there was Stephen Bernard of the Alfred Hospital. And Victorian MICA has a unique system of paramedics, of critical care paramedics. It's one of only two systems in Australia that has credentialed paramedics provide rapid sequence intubation with drugs. I guess Queensland could still be considered part of that, but that's only a very small unit within Brisbane that is allowed to do that. But Victorian MICA are probably the lead team in terms of the paramedic-led RSI service. So they published a study back in 2010, I think, in surgery, Annals of Surgery, and it basically said that paramedics could do pre-hospital RSI for traumatic brain injured patients and have an improved extended Glasgow outcome score at 6 months, and it was the first time ever that anyone had demonstrated that. There was a large study done in New South Wales in your neck of the woods called the HURT trial.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of money spent there, and unfortunately it wasn't a very well conducted trial in terms of the data collection and I guess the crossover of the groups. So unfortunately it came up with a negative result. It didn't really find a difference between the paramedic group, the ground paramedic group and the flight, the helicopter ambulance physician-led team providing one of many things, pre-hospital RSI. Yep. So we thought that was going to show us something, but it didn't, mainly the fact that there was problems with the trial itself. So intriguingly, to this day in the world literature, it's only a paramedic-led randomized controlled trial with pre-hospital RSI that's been shown to have some proven benefit. Apart from that, there's been a whole bunch of other trials that showed no benefit. So classically, the San Diego RSI trial is quoted. That was an interesting trial. It was a randomized controlled trial. The paramedics involved only got an average of 16 hours of pre-trial training, and then they were released upon the public and were, you know, under the trial, were allowed to do a rapid sequence intubation. And they had terrible outcomes. So people did worse with that, died more. More chance of desaturation, more chance of hypotension. So I think that trial basically says if you don't have the right training and the right governance and audit systems, you definitely, I think Scott Weingart quite rightly says that the laryngoscope can be a murder weapon and you can get a license to kill. And that's the big controversy within pre-op RSI, is that should it still be a practice done? And if so, how can that be done? And often the main argument is that it should only be done by physicians. I don't subscribe to that. I think if you have the right training, the right governance, then you can do it as well as anyone else. And certainly the Victorian MICA are a good demonstration of that. Flight nurses and paramedics over in America, clearly they've been doing that for years. Yeah. And no one's saying that, my God, they're killing everyone. Mm. So I think the flight paramedics and nurses over in North America show that with the right training and experience and governance, then they can do it quite safely. And just yesterday I was communicating with one of the flight nurses in Canada, yeah, who does flight, flight transports, aeromedical retrieval. And they routinely go to some of the most, severe and most difficult situations, patients with, terrible airway problems, and that they have no physician on board. It's them and their fellow paramedic or nurse, they handle it.
Yeah.
And they often are going to places where a rural doctor is not confident in handling the airway, so they get called. So they're the backup. I think it all depends on your training. And intriguingly, in Australia, I think that certainly the Victorian market show that. Queensland, Brisbane Road Trauma Service with the critical care paramedics have shown that. And really, I think it's just a bit of a political football that gets kicked around a bit about, who should be doing pre-hospital RSI and so forth. But that's the nature of it at the moment.
Mm. So what's the process behind performing an RSI? What do you have to do?
I think I can tell you what I do, but yeah, to be honest with you, I think that that there's a bit of what's the word? I think that it's probably not so helpful to know. I guess how could I put this? To know one way of doing it, it's probably helpful to know and adopt the way that your system wants you to do it. So, and I guess the reason why I say that is that traditionally in anaesthesia, when I did my training, there was always some other person, some other teacher who would tell you that this was the way to do it and so forth. And really what I've learned over time is that it's not so much a set technique, it's actually just a concept. It's rapid sequence intubation, even though originally it was described in a very rigorous way of 18 steps. For example, in the original description by Stepp and Safar, they said, you had to put a nasogastric tube down, you had to empty the stomach, you had to pre-oxygenate, you had to use cricoid pressure, you had to, do a number of things, you had to use these drugs and so forth. But now I think really, I guess after doing it for so long, really the thing is that it is a concept. It is a principle of airway management that is probably more important to adhere to. And the whole idea of that is that you need to do it rapidly. You need to do it in a way that avoids complications, so avoids hypotension, hypoxia. So it's a rapid thing, minimise complications, do it best on the first pass, so make your first pass the best attempt. So really safety is in doing it only once. So these are just general guiding principles. How you actually do that is probably not as important. So, what drugs you use, it's probably not that important, actually. And it's probably, I know it's not that important. So I think that they're the guiding principles that I use. There are certainly obviously things that I do routinely.
Yep.
And I think that, once again, these are the principles of rapid sequence. So the reason why, traditionally in rapid sequence, in the original paper, you didn't bag valve mask, face mask, ventilate the patient at all.
Okay.
So to allow that to happen, you need to adequately pre-oxygenate. So the principle of no bagging was to hopefully not inflate the stomach and cause a lot of half-digested cannelloni to come up. And so that's an important principle. But if you don't bag and just allow someone to be apneic, obviously that puts you at risk of violating the other principle, which is avoid hypoxia or avoid hypotension, you know, avoid that. So therefore, the way to prevent that is the principle of pre-oxygenation.
Yeah.
Okay? So that's an important principle of rapid sequences: pre-oxygenation, rapid securing of the airway, minimize complications by trying to get first pass success. And in some ways, that has evolved to, I guess, a more finessed, more modern way that we do rapid sequence, certainly in the pre-hospital setting, basically based on things that we knew for a while but just were never incorporated. So things like apneic oxygenation with nasal cannula that has been described for a long time, actually, but it, just because it was never put in the rapid sequence intubation technique description and taught from generation to generation, it's never been done until recently when people realise, well, actually, this makes a lot of sense. And if you want to maximise first-pass success, it's not so much about the drugs. It's about getting some of those, those things like pre-oxygenation right. I think that if you fundamentally get pre-oxygenation right, really, you are going to set yourself up for a very good first pass attempt success, and people often neglect that. People often rush to, you know, they kind of skimp on the pre-oxygenation, think, oh well, we just need to get the tube in and give the drugs as quickly as can. Need to get the tube in as quickly as can, which is a half truth. It's actually, if you can maintain oxygenation, then you don't need to rush. You can take your time and do things carefully and with a very careful technique. So I guess the principles is pre-oxygenation, you want it to be generally a rapid technique. You want to minimize complications by having a first pass success. So that they're the three principles I adhere to. Now, in terms of how do you routinely set it up, yes, I think there is some value, particularly if you're learning to have a routine. And yes, I certainly think that something like a checklist will help. But
I was just about to ask about the checklist. I've got the separate one sitting in front of me right now.
Yeah. But see, this is the paradox: is that you know people have got different checklists. So who's right? Who's wrong? And then really, when you look at it, there is no right and wrong. There is just one way of doing it, and what suits you. What are you going to remember? What are you going to be able to do at 3 o'clock in the morning when you haven't slept for 24 hours, and you need to do it? I think that's more important. And so, to be perfectly honest, in my practice, I've memorized everything. I don't rely upon a checklist because I rely upon the fact that I've memorized it all.
Yeah.
And that's just what I do. So I've memorized the Soap Me mnemonic, which actually Levitan taught me. I just tell my assistant, you know, well, let's check the suction, let's check the oxygen, let's check our airway equipment, let's position the patient, let's consider pre-oxygenation now, let's put on the monitoring, let's check our medications, and let's think about our extension of anesthesia plan. And that's basically it. I've memorized that.
Yeah.
And to me, I guess that was my point when I was debating Tim, was that really, at the end of the day, if this is going to be an important intervention that you want to provide, you want to train to the level that you don't need a checklist, that it's absolutely, you know, it's like tying your shoelaces. It's something that you do automatic. And I'm not saying, though, that there isn't benefit, and I certainly say that at the beginning, when you are only starting to do this and you've only got, you know, a few hundred under your belt, having a good checklist and someone checking with you is a good idea. We know from the anaesthetic literature that it takes approximately 57 intubations before you get at least 90% confidence in getting the tube in. So it takes time. Now, intriguingly, you know, technology has made it that we probably can reduce that number. But But anyway, back to RSI, I think that, yeah, that's what I use. So I try to stick to the principles that I've just talked to you about.
Yes.
And I use a very brief mnemonic. And that's the standard. And then unfortunately, you have to sometimes break the standard and you have to sometimes break the standard setup because some patients just won't fit. And this is where evolution of the techniques has occurred. So this is where, Scott Weingart's DSI technique has come into play, where that's obviously a complete different to your rapid sequence. You're actually not making it any as rapid as possible.
Mm.
But intriguingly, it still is adhering to a principle that is still important in RSI, which is pre-oxygenation. So if you're having trouble pre-oxygenating the patient because they're, fighting and combative, then often before DSI, I would and others would, that we would just, push the drugs and just rely upon the fact we can get the tube in as quickly as possible, which is, that's a way of doing it. I wouldn't say it's the safest, but that's a way. But now, I use DSI as an option. It's a modified rapid sequence. But it's an option where you want to have good pre-oxygenation because that's an important part of rapid sequence intubation, or I guess we should call it emergency intubation. And you want to maximise pre-oxygenation, which actually, when you see it done, it shows you that the principles are actually where the safety is. If you adhere to the principles, so, rather than saying combative patient, we can't pre-oxygenate, they can't hold on the mask, we'll just push the drugs and try to get the tube down. You say, no, that's not acceptable. The principle of rapid sequence intubation or emergency intubation should be maximal pre-oxygenation to give you the best chance of first pass success. And so, therefore, we give them a drug, ketamine, for example, and try to pre-oxygenate them as best as we can. So, that's where you have the standard technique, but then you need to be aware of when you need to modify it. And I guess this gets back to the argument about saying, the safety of RSI, particularly pre-hospitalised RSI, is saying that it does take some experience to realise when it's not safe to do it the standard way.
Yeah.
And you need to modify it. And then that's where I guess people can run into trouble. I think it really doesn't matter what your professional background is. I think anyone can learn it as long as you have the right training and the right governance.
Yeah.
Anyone can do it, but I think my point is that there's no shortcuts.
Yeah. Okay. Nice. So what are some common, I don't want to say mistakes, but what are some common problems that you see with people starting out with RSI when they're quite new to it? What are some mistakes that beginners need to be aware of and need to figure out when to avoid?
Yeah, sure. I guess this gets back to some basics of just airway anatomy. I think the biggest one that I learned in my career, even going through anesthesia, it actually wasn't, I realise now, it wasn't done very well at all. And now we have the tools as well as the technology and the ability to disseminate teaching widely that we don't need to put up with bad airway teaching anymore. And so the first thing I would say is about knowing your anatomy. And that sounds very basic, but I think it is absolutely the linchpin about how you start a good education in emergency airway management and then as a part of that rapid sequence tracheal intubation. So I think that's one of the very basic biggest mistakes is that people gloss over the anatomy. They don't really want to understand it in absolute detail.